Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand Studies channel of the New Books Network. My name is Bede Haynes and I am hosting today's episode. Before we begin, I would like to pay my respects to the First Peoples of this nation, past, present and future. And today we have a wonderful guest, Professor Henry Reynolds. We're discussing his book, Truth-Telling. And Professor Reynolds is a renowned Australian historian, grew up in Tasmania, worked for a long time at James Cook University up the other end of the country in Townsville, and as I understand it now, is back as a professorial fellow at the University of Tasmania. So good afternoon, Henry.
Good afternoon. Nice to be speaking to you.
Thank you very much. Now, the book we're talking about today is called Truth-Telling, History, Sovereignty, and the Uluru Statement. It's a book which follows the history of, or it's a tale of the history of Australia, particularly the way in which the British came to the country and the effects of that and what can be done about it. Now, could you let us know, Henry, to begin, how you came to write this book? What made you wish to write this particular book?
Yes. Well, it basically came as a result of me thinking about the Uluru Statement. And in that statement, there were really three basic issues that were addressed. And one was a voice to Parliament, and that is the issue which has been taken up and discussed and the committee's meeting about it. But the two other questions that I think are equally, if not more important, were firstly the question of sovereignty, and second, the desire for truth-telling. And so the book really is in two parts. The first part is dealing with the question of sovereignty, and the second part is looking at truth-telling. Mm-hmm. So it is a direct response to the Uluru Statement, although in doing so, it obviously goes in many directions because the questions are often quite complex.
Yes. Now, can I begin? I would like to begin our discussion by talking about the concept or the term First Nations. Yes. And I understand that term, or in my understanding, refers to earlier human inhabitants of a particular parcel of land, in this case, the continent of Australia and surrounding islands. But the expression is first, not First Nation, but First Nations. So it seems to signify more than a homogenous whole, but actually distinct nations and territories.
Yes, and I think that's the most important thing. I think when the Europeans approached Australia, they had the idea that they were dealing with one nation, you know, they were dealing with one race, one people. Now, that's not the way that the people themselves looked at the situation. The map of Australia, the map of in, Indigenous Australia is a very complex one. It is a mosaic of small language groups. And, you know, in a sense, those language groups have been reasserted as a consequence of land rights and the need to establish which people have, you know, putative rights over a particular piece of territory. So, in my view, these small groups were indeed nations, even though very small by European standards. Now, we know this to a large degree because of the languages. There are many different languages, and they were certainly of long standing, and modern linguistic analysis indicates that in many cases there was very little interchange. So these small nations maintained their independence and their commitment to their own language, their own customs, their own history over a long, long period of time. So there was no word meaning Aboriginal or Indigenous people. They saw themselves as belonging to their nation. And this became apparent to the Europeans soon after they'd arrived in Sydney. The idea that as they approached Australia, the idea was that these people wandered across the country, had no real commitment to a particular place. But that was clearly not the case, and they came to realise that very quickly. And they came to realise that as they travelled inland, they continually came across new people with different languages. And yes. even their Aboriginal guides that they frequently took with them soon came across people they couldn't understand. So, yes, I think the idea that this was a mosaic of small nations is the way to regard it.
Yes, and you give some very, to me, enlightening examples in the book where people were, Indigenous people were guiding Europeans around the place, and they did come across a territorial boundary, and there were actually customs observed, not just the language change, but there were actual...
Oh, yes. Diplomatic protocols.
Hmm. Now,
so that it flies in the face of that idea that we were dealing with one people or one race. They didn't see themselves in that way at all. And in a sense, they've gone back to confirming that they, come from a particular group, or increasingly from two or three groups because of intermarriage.
Yes. Then the book itself has this, refers to the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Could you explain for our audience what that is?
Well, it was a statement issued by a large gathering of Indigenous Australians from all over the continent who met at Uluru. And over a long, a long gathering, much discussion, they drafted a statement which was addressed not just to the Australian government, but to the Australian people. Now, it was the culmination of a process that had been going on for some years. That is, there'd been meetings all over the country. There'd been much discussion. And so when the statement was finally drafted, it represented more than just the view of those who were there. It was a distillation of the ideas. Now, there certainly were some dissidents who didn't go along with it, but nonetheless, I think it was the most interesting and important statement of the largest representative gathering that probably has ever been held in Australia.
Right. Now, with the statement itself, which is actually replicated toward the beginning of the book. The statement states that the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were the first sovereign nations of Australia. And then it says quite powerfully that the nation has never been, or their nations have never been ceded or extinguished, and they coexist with the sovereignty of the Crown.
Yes.
Now, one question I had about that was, there's almost an internal inconsistency there, because, yes, you can say, well, they as a matter of fact, they were never ceded and they were never extinguished. But then the statement itself gives some credence to the sovereignty of the Crown over the very same land. How is that best understood?
Well, I think the best way to express it is that, and this is an idea which is not commonly understood, that you can divide sovereignty into external and internal sovereignty. What it suggests, I think, is that the Indigenous Australians, the people at Uluru, recognise the external sovereignty of the Australian state. That is, the Australian state represented Australia to the outside world. But inside Australia, with internal sovereignty, there was a continuity of Aboriginal sovereignty, and this coexisted. Now, this is an idea. Two things. One, this is not a common idea. This is an unusual idea for many Australians to comprehend. But also, it comes into conflict with, you have to say, profound legal doctrine.
Mm.
And the profound legal doctrine is that there is only one sovereign eternally. And that is the sovereignty, well, it's shared between, obviously, by the Constitution, between the Commonwealth government and state governments. But they are the only holders of internal sovereignty. And that goes right back to the very start. I mean, the problem began even before the British arrived in 1788, because the assumption in Britain was that the Aboriginal, the Indigenous people of Australia, either weren't there, that the continent was, to a considerable extent, empty, or the local people who lived there did not have any form of sovereignty because they moved across the land with no clear ties to the land. So the British, when the British arrived, they became the first and only sovereign. Now, that's not the way it operated anywhere else in the on the boundaries of the European Empire. So let's take North America, for instance. Now, the French, the Dutch first, and the French, and the British, and the Spaniards, always recognised that the Indian peoples had rights. They had rights to the land on which they lived, but also they exercised an internal sovereignty. And the United States doctrine enunciated by the Supreme Court, the famous Marshall Court of the American, said that the Indians were domestic dependent nations with their own internal sovereignty. That is, they had the right to use their own laws and customs on their country. Now, that's the difference. Now, that wasn't the view in Australia. The view in Australia was there was no sovereignty when the British arrived, and therefore there was no need for treaties or conquest because there wasn't any sovereign there. It was a desert in terms of sovereignty. Now, that's why the Uluru Statement is, in a sense, revolutionary, because they are saying, no, that our sovereignty has survived and it can coexist with the sovereignty of the Crown. And in a way, we don't understand that North America was settled by the British in the United States and Canada by the signing of treaties. And that was also the case in New Zealand, as people will know, the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840. And that was a recognition that the Indigenous people had a form of sovereignty, and it had to be treated. You know, that they came to the table and they could treat and determine terms in which their sovereignty would survive.
Yes, and with that notion, I want to talk a little bit about, as the interview goes on, but a bit later on as well. At this stage, the concept of the First Nations, it seems to me at least to have a certain tragedy in the term itself, because if you were the First Nation, you're never really going to call yourself the First Nation until someone turns up and they reckon they're the people running the show. So you, and is in a way what you've just articulated then a way of saying, well, we don't have to lose our status as being the First Nation. We're not talking about just us having a property right under your law. We're talking about us, well, not me, but the Indigenous, the First Nations peoples being actually still the First Nation, and that there is a nation there that needs to be wrestled with under the law of the land.
Yes, it quite clearly suggests that the only resolution of this jurisprudential problem is the drafting of new treaties. Now, once again, this is a new idea in Australia, but it's a very old idea, for instance, in Canada and, as I said, New Zealand. But the Canadian example is perhaps the one which is most relevant to Australia. One, because it is equally a vast country with a great many different Indian and Inuit nations, and that the British government in Canada started signing treaties in the 18th century, and it did so right up to 1920. And the whole settlement of the great wave of settlement from the lakes to the Rockies, you know, the plains, the great plains of North America, the prairies. This was all settled by means of treaty making, treaties negotiated between the Indians and the Canadian state, represented by the mounted police. And they're called the numbered treaties, and they still exist. Almost every Indian from this area belongs to one of the treaty areas. And the treaties, they certainly meant that the Indians lost a lot of their land, but they had reservation land, they had certain rights on the reservation, and every year there was an exchange of gifts, and that still happens. And in some of the provinces, Treaty Day is still a public holiday. Now, that process ended in the 1920s. But that meant that in British Columbia and right across the north, you know, the vast cold north, there were no treaties. And so the Canadians in the last 20 years have started writing new treaties. And these are a model, I think, for what could happen in Australia. That is, they are treaties with groups of related nations who have cultural similarities and live in particular areas. And these treaties are negotiated with the Canadian government. And they say quite clearly, these are negotiations of two sovereign holders. And they work out a quite detailed treaty-making process. It leads to some land being granted freehold. It deals with the Indian involvement in development and resource development. It deals with the income that the Indians will receive, and also their right to self-determination, that is, to run their own affairs using their own customary law. Now, this is, this is quite a thoroughly long understood process in North America, and it's that sort of process I think we need to look at.
And with those, with with those processes, Henry, what is the likely benefit to the local First Nations people? Because a couple of ideas or a couple of images come to my mind are that if you think about the Inuit in Canada or Indigenous people in lots of countries that were colonies of Western countries, the First Nations peoples even now seem to be in a worse position than the European descendants. And it maybe a treaty these days might give some more material benefit to these people, but a lot of traditionally it doesn't seem that these people got a lot out of it. As you said, they gave up pastoral land and things like that. So
Yes. Well, I think the new treaties, that is the new Canadian treaty making process, is indeed providing real benefits. It is establishing a means by which the Indians and the Inuit can have a significant degree of internal self-government, and that they also negotiate income streams from resource development, and it gives them an actual status in a way in the constitutional arrangement of the Dominion, and I think that is important. And let me say, I think people have missed the significance of the agreement that the Western Australian government has just recently concluded with the Noongar people. That is the different groups, related groups, occupying the whole southwest of Western Australia, and it's a very large area. And over a long period of time, all the different small groups, small nations, came together and negotiated with the government, and it has just been concluded. It had to go through a process of being challenged by dissidents. It went right to the High Court, I think. But now it is in operation, and it saw a return of of any Crown land automatically returns to the Noongar people. They have institutions that have been established to manage much of their own affairs. It provides compensation of a considerable amount of money and investment in all sorts of improvements in their social circumstances. Now, various scholars who have looked at this see this as really the first modern treaty, even though it hasn't been called that in Western Australia itself. But that, I think, is the first of these big regional agreements, which I think could be seen as treaties.
Yes. Your book has the title Truth-Telling, then it has the subtitle, the subheading, Sovereignty, History, and the Uluru Statement. There must be an important role in your mind for this concept of truth, not only truth, but actually telling truth. Is that a necessary precondition or precursor to enabling people like me who are not Indigenous to actually seeing why treaty formation makes sense and should actually be followed? Could you explain what the role of truth-telling is?
Yes, well, in a way, it's similar to what has happened in many parts of the world in the last generation, although it probably can be traced back to the decision after the Second World War to set up the Nuremberg Trials. Now, you probably know, Stalin said, look, we know their crimes, we should simply execute maybe 10,000 of them, not the leading Nazis. But the American view was that no, it is important. We certainly think many of them should indeed be condemned to death. But we need to have a public forum where the full facts of what can be discovered is made public. And that this is in itself important to try and make certain that this can never happen again. Now, since then, and there have been organisations called truth commissions. That's the generic title. In many parts of the world, particularly at the end of a particular problem period. Now, this was so with the end of apartheid in South Africa. This was true at the end of dictatorships in military dictatorships in places like Chile and Argentina and Uruguay, and also in Central America, but also at the end of the communist era in Eastern Europe. So these truth commissions have had varying degrees of success, but above all, the victims have taken the view that this allows them to tell their story, pardon me, and to be heard, and that this is necessary if one is to overcome the terrible problems inherited from the past. Now, in a way, we haven't had anything like this in Australia, although we had two different bodies. You'll recall, we have just been talking very recently in the last few days about the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Death and Custody, and then the Human Rights Commission inquiry into taking children away.
Mm.
Now, in a sense, these were both truth commissions looking at very specific questions. And it's that sort of process that I think needs to be done, looking at the general history of Australia. And I just think there has been a lot of history written, and a lot of films and novels. There's been a lot of people examining the past, but I do think it would benefit from having a serious process backed by the state, and if not by the federal government, then by the different states. And in some ways, the states, the Commonwealth government itself had no responsibility for Aboriginal affairs at all until 1911, when they took control of the Northern Territory. And so much of what happened, of course, happened as a result of the different colonial governments. So whether it's a process of different states or whether it's a central national process, I do think we need some sort of considerable attempt to look at this and look at it seriously.
Yes, and I have a sense, like your view on this, that time is also quite essential here, because as each generation passes, there are so many of these First Nations around Australia that the customs and traditions would be harder and harder to keep. So, and especially when you look at the High Court decisions where connection to land is particularly important to acknowledge native title, the more time passes, do you think that would have a lessening the ability of the nation to buy into this concept of treaty making, so it ought to happen sooner rather than later?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think that's very much the case. I mean, in a way, it's interesting that you mentioned this. The whole process of investigating, the whole process of Native Title Tribunal, of investigating claims to land, thorough investigations, hearing of witnesses, and then decisions. This has been a very important process, but in a sense, the raw material is widely scattered, held in many, many different places, and I just think it needs the power and the wealth of government to pull all this together.
Yes, and you, in your work, you talk about Eddie Mabo and the famous Mabo decision from the High Court in the 1990s, which did turn over the notion of terra nullius and said that that land rights could persist in the Murray Islands in that case.
Yes.
And it's, which, I mean, that case obviously has a lot of tragedy around it. The plaintiff himself, Mr. Mabo, was deceased by the time the decision was given. And also it seems, of course, it was a great decision for the people of the Murray Islands, but their community made it, their particular circumstances seemed to me to be something that the Australian or the British law could cling on to, as saying, these people did have a use of land in the way we understand it, that could almost disenfranchise so many other people who just didn't have the cultivation that was apparent on the Murray Islands. Could you comment on that?
Yes, that's true. And my view all along, and this goes right back to my earliest discussions with Eddie Mabo, was that indeed they were in a different situation. Their way of life, their economy, their language was much more Papuan than it was Australian. And so they were, in that sense, it was the ideal place to run a land rights case. But it was the court itself, literally late in the piece, that asked the litigants to make a claim about the whole of Australia. And that was the revolutionary thing. They couldn't confine themselves, indeed, to those two inhabited islands, Murray and Darnley. And that would have ended it. But they didn't. The court said, we are looking at underlying principles. And the underlying principle was that the English law, the common law at the late 18th century, was perfectly able to recognise occupation, regardless of the form of economic activity. And therefore, the principles that they developed about Murray Island applied to the whole of Australia. Now, that was the revolutionary aspect of the judgment. So it didn't matter. And, I mean, this was the jurisprudence of North America and of New Zealand, that it goes back to that fundamental principle, goes back to common law, goes back to Roman law, that the people who live on the land must be considered to have a title to it. And in a way, you have to disprove. I mean, the whole idea of possession is 9/10 of the law. I mean, in a way that is so deeply rooted in as I say, both British and European law.
Mm. And with the idea then of, I mean, there are tragic examples, or it seems to me tragic examples, where the connection can't be formed. And I'm sure your book does discuss it. I can't remember where, but the Yorta Yorta case.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, that's right.
Which seems to be the High Court as well, but just such different circumstances and such a different outcome.
Yes, and that was, I mean, this goes. I think they went back and looked at Brennan, you know, saying that the tides of history had washed away their traditional knowledge. But other means had to be found to finally recognise that the Yorta Yorta did have claim on land, but in that part of Australia it can only be claim on land that doesn't is already owned by someone else with a crown title. But it does recognise a traditional link. And what has happened is that as well as Mabo, there was the Wick judgment, which recognised the continuing right of the local people on all lands that were in the pastoral lease. And that meant a great deal of Australia, particularly right across the north. And also it did recognise that that people had a continuing interest. Now, the nature of the interest had to be determined. And what has happened is that alongside, parallel with people making claim on the native title, is the process of establishing land rights agreements, land use agreements. And the last time I looked, there were over 1,000 of them that had been negotiated. whereby the Native Title Tribunal comes along and brings together the local Aboriginal people. It brings together local government, other landholders, state governments who might have, you know, rights over forests and other land, and they come to a land use agreement. Now, these, because this, in a way, the process is much expedited, it seems that many people are seeking to have their rights recognised as a process of the land use agreements rather than Native Title cases going through the courts.
Right. And is there a, so that's, that to me suggests that that's a practical outcome. It gets the result that is required, and there just seems to be a resignation that, well, if I put it this way, the decisions you've been speaking about then all involve Indigenous people who I expect would turn up to the courtroom thinking, this is our land, we just need, we don't care how it happens, but this court has to acknowledge that, and we will just take the decision. But it does seem to have a bit of bitterness, because the Indigenous people are saying, we fit within your law, not you don't fit within ours.
And yeah. Yes. That's clearly the case. But as I say, there's still quite clearly an acceptance of using the Native Title legislation and the Native Title Tribunal. The problem, or one of the problems, is clearly that it's a very, very long-running process, very expensive.
Mm.
It can sometimes take 10 years, as many people will know. Often, as in the case of Mabo, the original traditional owners have passed while the case has been working through the courts. And so the land use agreements is a much quicker way, and it's not for me to say whether this is a good thing or not, but it's quite clearly the case that many hundreds of Aboriginal groups all over the country have decided that land use agreements are the best and quickest way in which they can get just the recognition that they have continuing interest in a particular area of land.
Yes. And with your role as a historian in this area, long-standing contribution to the area, you have a chapter in the book called The Cost of Conquest. And I'd like to ask you what you feel the role of historians is in actually contributing to, or trying, assisting, bringing about this notion of treaties or justice for First Nations people. It seems that there is quite a firm cultural divide in Australia. There's people can take strong views against any giving up any type of land. These are Western people. And what is the historian's role in actually contributing to this process?
Well, at the very beginning, I think, and this, when I say the beginning, in terms of where you start, but it's where also my career began, because I started teaching Australian history at a time when the Aborigines had virtually been written out of the story. I mean, literally, my first course was one which I was teaching that was based on the University of Queensland course, and the textbook, very, very well known, widely used Australian history, general history, did not have anything about Aborigines. They weren't even mentioned in the index.
Is that Mr. Hancock's book?
No, not a generation later. It was Greenwood editor, Australia Social and Political History.
Right.
And so that was the most widely used textbook. It was finished in about 1955, and for 20 years, it would have been the most widely used textbook on on Australian history in senior schools and universities. And in many ways, it was a good book. It was multi-authored. But the extraordinary thing was there was nothing about the Aborigines.
Why was that?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, you see, I was living in North Queensland, and I knew that this was extraordinary. And I was teaching students who knew that it was an everyday issue that Aborigines and Islanders were in the community, but the relations between, what we used to call race relations were an everyday concern. So I knew that this was an extraordinary thing, but if you were living elsewhere in Australia, it didn't seem to matter. When I started to realise this extraordinary absence, I looked at all the reviews of this book. And if you were not an author with a chapter in that book, you would have reviewed the book. And not one of the reviewers saw what I saw, the absence, the complete absence of the Aborigines in the story. So my first task was to, and because there were almost no books, so I had to go back to the original sources, beginning in Queensland, and eventually, over a period of about 10 years, I went all over Australia to all the libraries and archives, and also to material in Britain, to try and tell the story of what happened, to fill in the absolute blank spots. And so that's the most important thing, is to actually go into the 19th century documents in particular and bring out the raw material.
Mm.
And that raw material then is a resource for students, but also other people who don't want to do that work, but they want to know. And so that's true of novelists and poets and songwriters and filmmakers and visual artists who use that quarried material to understand the story that had been left out.
Yes. And with the story that's been left out, your book does go through several massacres, really defeats of Indigenous people by settlers or by army men. And that in itself seemed to touch a raw nerve in Australia. I mean, I was at university when Mr. Winchardle seemed to have different views from you on a lot of these matters. And it was it seemed to me at least as though there was almost like some historians were saying, I have my view and my view is what this evidence must support in some way, shape or form. And that led to criticism of people who seemed to be pointing out that there were atrocities in the past. Could you comment on that?
Yes. It was a period of intense controversy. I was really quite expecting this. It took much longer than I thought, because it was so shocking. I mean, for several generations, Australians grow up and they're taught that it was a very uniquely peaceful history. Then it comes the shock when, in their middle years, someone comes along and says what you were told was wrong, that it was an utterly different story. So it's not surprising that people reacted and they didn't want to come to terms with this. And there's no doubt that many people were only too pleased when Keith Windschuttle said we'd largely made it up. It was fabrication, as he said.
Mm.
So that there was, in a sense, people found this reassuring. But what has happened since then, and that was now 20 years ago, that the controversy itself was, uncomfortable at the time, but what it did was to stimulate a whole new generation of scholars, mainly working in universities and doing theses, for instance, but a whole new generation of academics, of young academics, who went back to the source material and indeed confirmed everything that I've been saying, but also in a way, greatly increased the death toll. I mean, I had said, this was what Keith was arguing about. I said it is reasonable to suppose that at least 20,000 Aborigines were killed in the settlement of Australia. He said, no. But far from this being rejected for being too large, it's now rejected, I think, as being considerably too small. And I think that's right. I think I felt that I was, putting a basic floor under the likely death toll, and was willing to consider it was larger. But you were particularly in Queensland, but also in Tasmania, because that was the focal point of Keith Windschuttle's arguments. And there's no doubt that the death toll was much higher. The killing went on for a very long time. And it, whether or not we like it, it is an absolute central feature, an inescapable feature of Australian history.
Yes.
You can't hide from the manifest material. And the point is that in the 19th century, no one doubted that killing was going on. The debates then were whether it was necessary, whether it was an inescapable precondition of settlement, or whether it could have been far less violent. I mean, it wasn't whether killing was taking place, it's whether it was justified.
Yes, and we have to finish relatively soon, but I would like to ask a couple more questions about this. The first is, your book talks about this seems to grow year by year, whether Australia should change its national day from the 26th of January being the day in which it's understood that the First Fleet made some form of entry into Australia.
The 26th is the day that the fleet moved from Botany Bay. The fleet had arrived a week before. The last ships arrived on the 20th of January. I mean, an extraordinary achievement to bring 11 ships all the way, 6 months, 7 months, and bring them all to Botany Bay within a few days of one another. And, amazing. But they decided that Botany Bay wasn't the ideal place, and they found Sydney Harbour. And so the expedition moved to Sydney on the 26th. So it made sense if you want to celebrate the founding of Sydney, but it doesn't make sense more generally. Either you commemorate the arrival of the full fleet, or more significantly, I think, is the date February the 7th. When the proclamations were read, and the whole community, the whole, convict and soldiers and settlers and everyone gathered together, and Philip read the proclamations, which was the formal annexation of Eastern Australia. That is the date that represented the actual legal event.
Yes.
Now, that's the particular time, the couple of weeks in early Sydney. But my view is that this is a most inappropriate day to commemorate for a variety of reasons. And in particular, the British arriving with the idea that the indigenous people over, remember they only claimed the eastern half, New Holland, they didn't make claim on the west, which had been obviously discovered by the Dutch. So they claimed Eastern Australia, New Holland, a vast area. And within the claim, as we've already mentioned in this discussion, the idea that the Aborigines, one, had no title to the land. They didn't actually occupy the land. They moved across it. And two, they had absolutely no sovereignty. That is, they had no law and custom which regulated, but they were not organised societies.
Yes.
Now, that was so pernicious. It predetermined so much of the disaster that followed. And it was premised either on the mistake that the interior of Australia was largely unoccupied, and or the idea that the Aboriginal people were too primitive, unlike the North American Indians, unlike all the Indigenous peoples all over the world, they were uniquely primitive. Now, that, you know, as I say, that was an appalling foundation, and that's where so much of the trouble began. And so I think it is, you know, a particularly bad choice for Australia Day.
Yes. A final point I'd like to raise similarly to that is you mentioned the notion of the war memorial in Canberra doing something to acknowledge the harm done to the Indigenous people in essentially what were battles. And it's contrasted with the 200 poles that are erected at the National Gallery. And it seems the question I'd like to ask you to consider is, at the National Gallery, it's much more, it's a place where you can reflect on tragedy, and art gallery. It seems to have that vibe about it. Whereas the war memorial is just a place where either Australian soldiers die heroically or we win things. It doesn't have the bit where Australian soldiers committed, it doesn't have the section called atrocity in Vietnam or something like that.
No, indeed not. Well, you see, the people have, I mean, for the last 20, 25 years, going right back, many, many prominent Australians, I'm going back to Sir William Dean, you know, was saying this in the 1990s, and many, many other prominent Australians have said, well, why doesn't the War Memorial recognise the conflict within Australia? And many of the historians who actually worked in the War Memorial said this, some people like Peter Stanley. But the War Memorial has steadfastly refused to pick up this responsibility and have said, well, yes, we know all this, but it's the role of the National Museum, it's not our role. Now, I certainly for a long time felt that this, the War Memorial, really should be expected. And in fact, you know, if there was a government with any real sense of Australian history, they would have made it clear to the War Memorial Board that this was to be a part of their brief, and if necessary, amend the legislation. But I think now that they have indicated they have shown no interest in doing this. I'm not sure that they now are an appropriate institution to deal with this. I think now there should be indeed a separate museum in Canberra, as well-funded as the War Memorial, which will commemorate the whole story of conflict right across the continent, which, after all, was conflict about Australia, in Australia, and it went for, you know, nearly 150 years. And it is a story that needs to be told. And I think a new museum is what is required. And
yes.
Remember, Australia has just recently spent $100 million on a museum in northern France about the battles on the Western Front.
Mm.
Now, that is the sort of money that is required. And that, I think, is what should be done in commemorating the wars over the control and ownership of Australia, the Australian continent.
Yes, I think that's, in a way, that would tie in nicely with some of the comments you made at the start of this conversation, where the idea of the First Nations being coextensive with the Australian sovereignty, so that a second memorial looking at things the way you've just explained, in the capital of Australia shows, well, this nation has more than one nation sort of beneath its soil.
That's right. And it would become, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, it would become an important and very, very popular, not popular in a nice, jolly sense, but, and this is, I mean, the
slavery in Washington
mm.
is obviously of very, very great importance, and it's, you know, it's very hard to get into it because it was so much in demand. And it would become an extremely important national institution and would have outreach all over Australia, because every small of the small nations that now in most cases have formed, native title, have formed their own institutions, would then negotiate as to whether they wanted to commemorate the war in their part of Australia, in which case, how would they like to do it, and whether they would like to do it, like to also involve the white, the white people who were also killed in this process.
Yes.
And so every part of Australia would then be, there would be discussions and debates about what would be done. And I just think the variety and creativity that would be stimulated by this would make these monuments real places of pilgrimage.
Mm. Well, thank you for that, and thank you for your time today, Henry. Could you, before we leave, could you please let our audience know what you are working on now?
I'm actually going to start. I've just finished, along with my ex-PhD student, Nick Clements, a book which is a biography of the greatest of the Tasmanian warriors, a man called Tonga Longata, who no one has heard of, and yet he led the fight against the British. His people, we know as the Oyster Bay and Big River people in central Tasmania, they were undoubtedly the most effective resistance guerrilla fighters anywhere in Australia. And his story is astonishing. And this will, I think people will find this thoroughly amazing story of the incredible courage and determination these people had. There were probably 1,000 people of this part of Tasmania when the British arrived. Now, most of the fighting took place over about 5 or 6 years in the 1820s. And when they finally came to an agreement, an armistice, they didn't surrender. They came down to Hobart to meet the government carrying their spears. When they came to an agreement to end the war, there were only 26 of them left.
Gosh.
It is an astonishing story, and that is the story that we'll be telling, and it'll be published out on the 1st of August.
Oh, good. Well, that'll be, I've often thought there needs to be some Australian cinema. I mean, I've heard of people like Pemulwuy. These are stories that need to be brought to people's attention. I mean, when what you've just described then sounds like a book that we all must read.
Well, it's an astonishing thing. This extraordinary history of resistance, of desperate attempt to maintain their country and their way of life, no one even heard of the man. It's an indication of what has been wrong with the way we've been looking at Australian history.
Mm. And how did you come about? How did you find this person?
If you do as I did in the past, Tasmanian records are incredibly detailed and well kept because it was an open air prison. You had a huge bureaucracy that had to record everything. There were in Hobart months, and there were always 3 or 4 or 5 newspapers, local newspapers. So the record, the material is extraordinary. But you've got to get into it.
Mm.
And as I say, Nick Clements was my PhD student. Well, he's an honours thesis and then a PhD. So he worked for about 4 or 5 years on these records, and his thesis was published a couple of years ago called Black War. So if you stop, you know, it takes a lot of years of absolutely detailed research to uncover all of this. But as I say, it's an astonishing story. And I mean, you see, we'd always put this much effort into telling the story of our other wards. I mean, the great volumes of the First World War. It's not as if we didn't want to tell stories about war, but we simply didn't want to look at this from the point of view of those who were desperately endeavouring to preserve their way of life and their control of their country.
That's amazing. Well, thank you. Thank you, Professor Henry Reynolds. It has been an honour to speak with you, to hear these history recalled from you. Thank you for your books in the past as well, and for making yourself available today for the audience on this, the Australian and New Zealand channels of the New Books Network. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your interesting questions, and it seemed to be a good discussion.
Thank you very much.